It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Less than a month ago, the 119th Congress convened for the first time, and since then, there has been a flurry of activity. In the Oval Office, President Donald Trump's sweeping executive actions take aim at everything from diversity programs to immigration to artificial intelligence. To get a Wisconsin perspective on federal policy in the moment and the latest developments from Capitol Hill, we turn to 1st Congressional District Representative Republican Brian Steil. He represents areas including Janesville, Racine, and Kenosha. He leads the Subcommittee on Digital Assets, Financial Technology, and Artificial Intelligence. I spoke with Steil yesterday just as President Trump rescinded an order freezing federal assistance. We begin by discussing which moves by the Trump administration Steil is most supportive of for Wisconsinites and the nation.
Coming out day one, President Trump made some very strong and positive executive orders, in particular as it relates to border security. These were executive actions that we were calling on President Biden to take, but he refused. And so President Trump came in, reinstated stay in Mexico, is ending abuse of the parole system, restarting border wall construction, and making sure that we secure the U.S.-Mexico border has a real impact in Wisconsin, in particular as it relates to the flow of illicit drugs like fentanyl that have been coming across the border, both through legal ports of entry, but also significantly through illegal entry, as well as the scourge of human trafficking that we have seen play out as a result of the broken border policies we saw for the last 4 years.
Should immigration at the southern border be stopped altogether?
We should stop illegal immigration altogether. It's going to take not only the work of executive action by the president, but also the action and work of Congress. Last Congress, I was proud to support a border bill, what we called H.R. 2. It was a comprehensive bill to secure the U.S.-Mexico border, to make sure that we were supporting the men and women of Border Patrol, investing in technology, and also forcing the executive to take many of the actions that President Trump voluntarily just took. Putting that into law prevents a future president from unwinding it. And so while the executive actions are a good step forward, I think at the end here, legislative action is going to be needed to make sure that we secure the border completely.
On the flip side of that, could this affect Wisconsin communities? I mean, you look at an industry like dairy, which is very much a labor force of immigrant labor. Will this have an effect on particular industries?
Well, I think it's important to clarify the difference between immigrant labor that is legal labor and illegal immigrant labor. And I think that's very important, in particular, as we think about the labor markets in Wisconsin. So it's important to make sure that we have men and women who are taking the jobs that are available in our state. And as we think about the dairy industry, immigrant labor plays a critical role. H-1B visas, other agricultural visas, sometimes they fit the agriculture industry in Wisconsin, in particular during the fall harvest season. Sometimes they don't fit as well, in particular as we think about the dairy industry. But I'm of the belief that allowing some dairies to use illegal labor and undercut the labor market is not to the benefit. I'm of the belief that if we require everyone to abide by the rules, those dairy farms that are currently operating legally will no longer be undercut by dairy farms that are operating illegally. And I think that, to the end of the day, is to the benefit of Wisconsin farmers and all agriculture workers.
Moving on here to this potential pause on federal grants, loans, and federal assistance, the judge in D.C. has since blocked this pause. There's still confusion. Wisconsin state government receives $28 billion a year in federal assistance, the bulk of that going to Department of Health Services for Medicaid programs. That is according to the state legislature's nonpartisan fiscal bureau. Do you support a pause on federal funding?
Moments ago, that executive order was rescinded. I think what the president is making the statement on is there had been such aggressive, reckless spending under the Biden administration. We had to take a deep breath and determine where should federal dollars be going and where should they not be going. And on the way out the door, what we've identified and has been stated in the press is that President Biden was shoving money through in the final hours of his administration into areas that I don't think were appropriate. And we saw some instances of that in particular as it relates to foreign aid that were highlighted at a recent press conference. And so I think what the president broadly is saying is, let's take a deep breath and let's make sure that we're wisely using all of our tax dollars and we're not wasting any of it. Specifically, as it relates to the executive order, that's been rescinded. But I do think it's important that we comb through all federal government spending and make sure that it is actually a good use of taxpayer dollars, and we're not allowing taxpayer dollars to go to partisan pet projects that might have been authorized in the final hours of the Biden administration.
So with that said, how would you like the Trump administration to proceed on federal grants and loans? Should there be a pause of any type to evaluate such programs?
Well, I think what the administration is doing is going through with a fine-tooth comb on all of these programs. And again, this is trillions of dollars of federal government spending that is being spent in any given year. And so all of us working together play a real role here, right? I think all of us Americans are united on removing waste, fraud, and abuse, on making sure the tax dollars are going to their highest and best purpose. And so the vast amount of spending that was unleashed in the Biden administration, particularly in the first 2 years under Democratic one-party control, I think it's really important that we go back and review those programs and determine, are they really in the best interest of the country? Broadly speaking, I think we're best when our elected leaders in the House and the Senate are dictating those spending decisions. But over the years, and this goes back, you know, decades and decades, Congress has really given significant authority to the president over the authority of the House and the Senate. And this cuts across all administrations. I think we'd be best served to re-empower Congress in that appropriations process. That said, that's not where we are today. And so I think it's appropriate that we're reviewing a lot of the spending that went through at the end of the Biden administration to make sure that it's actually a good and appropriate use of taxpayer dollars.
We are checking in on the latest developments on Capitol Hill with Republican Representative Brian Steil, who serves Wisconsin's first congressional district. You're leading the subcommittee on digital assets, financial technology, and AI. What are your priorities as you head the subcommittee?
I look at two key priorities in the digital asset space. One is working to ensure that Americans' financial investments are safe and secure. And if we put forward rules of the road in digital assets and crypto and in other areas, we can make sure that we're moving forward in that direction. The other is to make sure that we're encouraging innovation and development here in the United States and not allowing us to be outcompeted by other countries like China. And so if we put forward a framework for digital assets investment, really the plumbing of our financial system here in the United States, we have an opportunity to encourage that innovation and development of Web3 here in America, rather than allowing foreign countries to take the lead in this space, which in many ways they are right now.
President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump, they launched crypto meme coins prior to Inauguration Day. And opponents say the president's coin has the potential to raise significant funds for his business empire. Is there a way to regulate crypto for this president and potential future presidents?
So inside of legislation that I've been working on last year, if we had that in law, and it's a bill that will hopefully have an opportunity to move forward this year, actually defining the market structure in crypto and making sure that we're working to protect and secure American investments, there would be a regulatory framework for all sorts of different digital assets, including meme coins. I think it's reasonable and appropriate for us to put forward a framework for the United States of America. Because at the end of the day, what it'll do is it'll protect investors, but also encourage innovation and development here in the United States.
Turning to TikTok, you support the law essentially banning TikTok unless its Chinese-owned parent company sells. The Supreme Court upheld the ban this month. And as recently, in recent days, you told WTMJ that the U.S. needs to force the sale of TikTok due to data collection concerns from China. President Trump ignoring that law, giving TikTok owners an extension. What do you make of that?
I think at the end of the day, what we're not upset about is the app itself. The app, in theory, can be used and could be fine. It's not fine today because the Communist Chinese Party, through their involvement in ByteDance, which is the company that owns TikTok, has backdoor access to Americans' digital technology. And so the law that passed Congress did not ban TikTok per say, what it did is it said we need to alter the corporate structure to prevent the Communist Party of China from having a backdoor into Americans' digital fingerprints. And so I think it's, at the end of the day, appropriate that we force that sale or divestiture, and hopefully we'll be able to reach that in the not-too-distant future.
So would you anticipate then people being able to use TikTok for the foreseeable future? And would it be available on federal devices, per se?
Well, all this is kind of playing out in real time. I mean, I would not encourage anyone to have TikTok under its current structure on their phone. I don't have it on my phone. And again, the reason for that is the Communist Party of China, through their involvement of the owner of TikTok, which is a company called ByteDance, has a backdoor access into your digital privacy, right? So it has access into your contacts, it has access maybe into your photos and other things. And exactly how that's operating on the back end of that is rather opaque. And so personally, I would not advise anyone to have TikTok on their phone. That's obviously a choice for any given American as to whether or not they want to take that risk. The action that Congress is taking is not to ban the app. If you want to go post silly videos of you dancing, there's nothing wrong with that, and the government shouldn't be involved in that. What we're simply saying is to protect Americans' privacy, and in particular their digital privacy. And as we know, Americans' phones are nuanced in what you're doing day in and day out. But to protect that, what we need to do is restructure the corporate ownership in the backdoor access that the Communist Party of China has due to their investment in ByteDance.
Congressman Stile, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Stile is the Republican U.S. representative for Wisconsin's 1st congressional district, representing areas including Janesville, Racine, and Kenosha. We spoke yesterday just as President Trump rescinded an order that would have put a freeze on most federal grants and loans. Coming up, a medical school leader in central Wisconsin responds to ThetaCare's plan to close its labor and delivery unit in Wapakoneta next month.
Those women will be driving, probably most often to other ThetaCare sites.
The economics of rural health care and providing obstetrical services, that's next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. ThetaCare Medical Center in Wapakoneta announced late last year it intends to close its labor and delivery unit on February 15th. The hospital system cited a low number of births, the increasing complexity of pregnancies, and having to compete with larger birthing centers outside the area, among other challenges. In response, members of the Wapakoneta community circulated a petition with thousands of signatures to pressure the health system to reverse its decision. And a Facebook group called Save Wapakoneta Labor and Delivery was formed. WPR spoke with members of that group, and here's some of what we heard.
I was about like 3.5 months away from giving birth when I figured out that I was going to have to find a whole different plan.
We were always the kind of community that was willing to do the right thing. And now we're feeling kind of powerless. The care providers that we live and work with, we love them. We're talking about the corporation that has sort of taken over care. Many of those physicians are going to leave here. They're families that are woven into this community. They're raising their kids here.
That was Cyndia Gullickson of Wild Rose and Marcy Reynolds, Sandy Teston, and Jane Peterson, all of WAPACA. To look closer at rural healthcare access, we called in Dr. Lisa Grill Dodson. She's founding dean and century dean of the Central Wisconsin campus of Medical College of Wisconsin. It's located in Wausau. Dr. Dodson has a background in practicing family medicine in a rural setting. Dr. Dodson, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Happy to be here.
You practiced family medicine in a rural area for years. How did that experience inform your understanding of healthcare in rural areas?
The rural health dilemmas have existed for decades, and lots of solutions have been proposed, sometimes not carried out for very long. So I think having practiced in a frontier rural area early in my career really informed the education role that I have now in creating and nurturing students who are willing to consider those kinds of careers, as the workforce problem has been going on for also quite a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you've ushered through, I think it's 6 medical school graduating classes in central Wisconsin. You know, what impact do you see on rural medicine when there is the teaching element of future doctors in a rural community?
Well, the reason that our campus is placed where it was is, even though Wausau is not highly rural, it is rural adjacent. So all of our students get experience working in smaller hospitals, critical access hospitals, and practices that are in small communities. We are starting to see that pay off in placement of our graduates in some of the harder to fill places in northern Wisconsin. We have graduates practicing in Medford and Merrill and some of the other really small communities where it's harder to recruit. So I think it's pretty essential that we exist near where we want them to practice, and they can see the high quality of care that can be practiced and the really rewarding practices that can happen in rural communities.
Looking at obstetrics, specifically ThetaCare's impending closure of its labor and delivery unit in WAPACA, which is part of a trend of fewer providers offering obstetrical care in rural parts of the state, why is this specialty leaving rural areas?
Well, it's complex. There's always lots of reasons, but the primary boils down to 2 things. One is finances, and the second is support for the workforce. Those two, there's many factors within each of those, but the 2 things that really put obstetrical care at risk is the workforce and the ability to pay for it.
So the workforce and the ability to pay for it. Can you talk a little bit more about the workforce around obstetrics?
So in rural areas, family physicians fill in a large percentage of the care that's provided, either exclusively or in partnership with obstetrical gynecologists, sometimes general surgeons, and certainly in some places, midwives are used in rural areas as well. But the largest workforce problem is, of course, recruiting physicians. There's a long training time, and certainly some physicians are not willing to go and practice in areas where they are the only one on call, sometimes for weeks or months on end. They may not have the skill set or feel like they have the skill set to practice the breadth that is needed there, and then the distance from referral centers and things like that. It's also, however, the hospitals themselves have to train nurses and technicians and all sorts of other people within the hospital system to address and deal with obstetrical problems that come up in the routine delivery as well as in complications. And so it's a combination workforce problem, not just physicians, but also many other healthcare providers that have to maintain their certifications, maintain their ability to care for a decreasing size of population of births in rural areas.
It makes me think about ThetaCare saying that the complexity of labor and delivery has been rising, and you know, in a rural area, you're not going to be able to go down the street to find a local, like, perinatal specialist or, you know, a physician who is handling a high-risk pregnancy, and then, you know, neonatal and caring for preemies. Can this be an issue when you're trying to refer out patients?
It is. I think that largely the birth has become no more complex than it ever was. Birth is birth. I think we have created systems in which expectations are different. The technology has changed and evolved in some very good ways to improve outcomes and make things safer. And that does make smaller hospitals a little at a disadvantage trying to keep up with all the technology and the new bells and whistles. But it does also create a problem in referring out with many different kinds of problems and the distance involved in managing a high-risk pregnancy when you're an hour or more away sometimes from the specialist involved here in Wisconsin.
I wonder if birthing people expect the, as you call, the bells and whistles, being able to have those resources right there within the hospital.
I think only to a certain degree. I think that most people who live in rural areas are quite accustomed to having the basic health care provided nearby and only needing to go to higher risk centers when there's something else going on that requires that. A standard birth, the pregnancy and birth, does not require a high risk center, does not require a high volume center. About a quarter to 40%, somewhere in there, of women deliver at low volume hospitals in the United States. Many of those are rural. Some of them are not rural. And, you know, outcomes are very good. And so I don't think it's a given that women want or need to hide the bells and whistles, as we would say. Hmm. And certainly many, many women don't want the drive.
So when, you know, people are in labor in Wapaka, where will they need to drive to? What might be the distance to give birth?
The closest would be Stevens Point, which is, I believe, 38 minutes by, you know, again, assuming no weather problems, construction problems, that kind of thing. But that's a different health system. And so most women will not be able to choose outside care outside of their health system. So the closest within the Theta Care network would be Neenah or Berlin, which are about 50 minutes away. Appleton's just a skosh farther than that. And then Shawano is a little over an hour.
Wow.
And those are the remaining birth centers that Theta Care offers.
Wow. Would that lead to more scheduled deliveries, perhaps? I mean, you don't want to be in active labor when you're driving.
Right. Yeah, that's certainly one of the unintended consequences is probably an increase in C-section rate, where you're just too far away. We'll go ahead and just, you know, move this along either with an induced labor or a C-section.
We're talking about obstetrical care in rural parts of the state and the future of rural medicine in light of Theta Care announcing the closure of its labor and delivery unit at its hospital in Wapaka. Dr. Lisa Dodson is here, Dean of the Medical College of Wisconsin's Central Wisconsin campus. Dr. Dodson, there was this report last year by the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health, and the most common reasons OB units close in rural areas are provider coverage, low reimbursement rates, and the low number of births, as you mentioned. None of these reasons are related to the health of parents and newborns or the health of a community as a whole. What stands out to you in this line of reasoning?
Well, I think overall, the biggest change that is needed is simply a change in mindset by legislators, health systems, patients themselves, everyone involved, that women's and children's health is an investment. It is not just an expense. Changing the oil in my car is an expense, but it is an investment in preserving the life of my car. And it's not different than that. Even the most mercenary among us should recognize that prenatal care saves money in preventing complications, preventing low birth weight, and many other things, which is why we want prenatal care to happen as locally as possible. Once the obstetrical services disappear from the hospital, it also becomes much harder to maintain prenatal and postnatal services and even care for newborns and children. So I think that mindset change is really where we need to focus and get us back to and recognizing this is an investment in our communities and in our health and in our young people, and stop kind of couching it completely in terms of just cost and whether it makes any money or not. Theta Care is not unique at that, and I'm not casting stones at them. This is a national problem, and there is certainly many, many, many closures of obstetrical units based on finances alone.
57% of rural hospitals in Wisconsin offer obstetrics. That number is going down, according to this report from the Office of Rural Health. What does it mean practically for someone expecting to give birth then in these communities when the local hospital doesn't offer labor and delivery? What do you do in that situation?
You drive.
You drive.
There are a few alternatives, home births with lay midwives and things like that. Most physicians don't recommend that as a course of action. And certainly people do follow that line. But you're basically getting in a car and driving for appointments and for follow-ups and for delivery itself.
Yeah, that makes sense. What do your medical students talk about when they look at this issue? What are their conversations like?
We have a unique group of medical students. We specifically select students for our campus who often come from rural areas and other underrepresented backgrounds. So many of them, particularly those interested in family medicine, are quite interested in obstetrics and providing those services to smaller communities. They will go find a place that they can do that within the state of Wisconsin or elsewhere. And there certainly are places, even within Wisconsin, that are expanding that. I think of Baldwin, which is a very small health system, Western health system over in the western side of the state. And they are expanding their health services, particularly important after several other closures of hospitals on that side of the state. So it is happening. And our students, I think, will seek out the places they can practice the scope that they would like.
Does it make a difference to be able to have your graduate students in these small community hospitals doing their training and completing their degree in a rural setting?
Of course. One of the reasons that we're here is because we are able to place our students with practicing physicians in smaller communities where our students really get to participate in the day-to-day care of the patients, as well as see really high-quality physicians doing a full scope of practice. That's really hard to see if you're practicing in Milwaukee or Madison or some other larger city, where you tend to see primary care physicians, having a much more limited scope of practice, able to refer out a lot more readily, and therefore they do that. And so I love having our students in some of our smallest hospitals where they're first assisting at surgeries and delivering babies and doing other things that you just don't get the opportunity as a student to participate in as fully in larger places.
I would imagine telemedicine has made an impact on areas of medicine in rural communities. But of course, with labor and delivery, that can't be the case. Are there perspectives here of telemedicine that could help out overall in obstetrics or no?
Sure. Yeah, I think particularly for things like high-risk monitoring. So if a round-trip, two-hour trip from Waupaca to Appleton, let's say, is what's needed, high-risk pregnancies are often being seen weekly or even more often than that during the last trimester of pregnancy. And so if we could do anything to have to eliminate some of that travel for both cost as well as safety reasons, traveling in Wisconsin in the winter is sometimes a little dodgy, and having the ability to provide telemedicine services to patients in rural areas, particularly those high-risk monitoring situations, that would certainly help. It, as you said, doesn't address the delivery piece, but it certainly may prevent some accidents on icy roads and, other things that we would like to avoid happening, plus just the cost.
Can you still manage vitals and do those other things that you would do in a doctor visit for telemedicine?
Sure. Yeah, there are all different kinds of ways that we can do remote monitoring now with blood pressure, even other much more sophisticated things than that. So there certainly are things that technology has brought us that make this a lot easier, regardless of where you are.
And as you watch the situation with ThetaCare unfold in Waupaca, do you have any thoughts locally, or what should we be watching for here as we get closer to the 15th of February?
Well, I think I assume that Waupaca has prepared those women for what's coming. I know there's some movement afoot to try to bring community support to bear to keep the unit there. I think that We're going to see, you know, this probably be completed in a very short period of time, less than about 2 weeks. And those women will be driving, probably most often to other data care sites. Hopefully we will not be seeing an increase in, you know, road births, underweight babies being born, you know, all the terrible outcomes that we try to avoid by providing local prenatal care.
Dr. Dotson, turning to you and your career, you'll be leaving your post as Dean of Medical College of Wisconsin Central Wisconsin campus later this year. What vision and values should the new dean have about rural healthcare and rural medical access?
Well, like I said, I think promoting this as not a luxury, but as a essential service that we need to provide. I think this is an investment in our communities, and I hope my successor continues to both seek out and recruit students who come from those backgrounds, because they're very underrepresented in the overall population of medical students, and also just continues to reinforce the importance and the value of providing this as an investment to communities. It's not just the health, but the unintended consequences of economic development. I mean, what business wants to move to a place where their young employees can't get the services that most of them need? You know, it's certainly one of the high areas of need for young families. Cancer screening, you know, chronic disease screenings, all of those things diminish when you reduce what a hospital or clinic can provide in a rural area. And my belief has always been that rural populations deserve the same great quality of care as everybody in the U.S. should have. And so I hope my successor will continue to emphasize that to our students and try to select students who are going to go out and meet that mission.
Dr. Dotson, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. It's good to talk to you.
That is Dr. Lisa Grill Dotson, Dean of the Central Wisconsin Campus of Medical College of Wisconsin that's located in Wausau. Dotson is stepping down from her role in June and will become founding Dean Emerita. She talked with us about issues facing rural obstetrical care and the future of rural medicine. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, find out how the city and county of La Crosse are working together on homelessness with emergency shelter, permanent housing, and prevention efforts.
Looking at how we can prevent folks from even dropping into that homeless category, even for a day, is really super important.
That's coming up next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Along the western border of our state, people experiencing homelessness are finding new housing opportunities and stability in their lives. City, county, and community agencies in La Crosse are working together to bring homelessness to what they call functional zero by 2029. That concept is a benchmark for when homelessness becomes rare or brief overall in a community because of its systems in place. And that system in La Crosse is an action plan called Pathways Home. So far, 88 people who formerly lacked housing now have a place of their own to call home. But there's still much work to be done. Tracking data shows nearly 275 people remain unsheltered in the area this winter. We're learning more now about La Crosse's community efforts to meet the needs of homeless individuals and to create additional housing in the area. Brian Sampson is the Homeless Services Coordinator for the City of La Crosse, and Jim Dries is the Homelessness Response System Manager for La Crosse County. They talked with Rob Ferret earlier this week.
Brian, I want to start with you. You are the first homeless services coordinator for the city of La Crosse. You've been at it a few years now. What kind of things have you learned? What have you learned from the situation there in those first three, 4 years on the job?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things that I've learned is just that it takes a system or a plan to really get a good hold on homelessness. You know, for the first year or two in this role, really just trying to do a lot of collaboration with homeless service agencies and a lot of good work happening in the city of La Crosse. However, having a five-year plan to address homelessness and having that infrastructure or backbone support that city and county government can bring to the table is extremely helpful in addressing homelessness.
And Jim, you're coming to this at the county level as the first homelessness system manager for La Crosse County. Since starting last June, what do you see as the greatest challenges facing the homeless community there?
Yeah, you know, it's really a twofold challenge around the specialized housing that folks need to meet them where they're at, and then the wraparound support services. And we've got a lot of agencies involved doing great work, but just trying to build a central coordination to make sure we're finding the folks and effectively serving them.
Brian, people might think homelessness and they think big city problem. La Crosse, medium-sized city, it exists there, clearly.
Yeah, homelessness is everywhere. I mean, it touches everybody, especially with state of our housing crisis and economy. It's really everywhere. There's not a place in the United States, at least, that's excluded from homelessness or people being at risk of losing their housing.
Jim, homelessness doesn't necessarily know borders either. La Crosse as a city has been dealing with this for a while. What is important to you about bringing together different levels of government, county, city, townships, whatever, to tackle this problem together?
I think that the community was wise in making this a shared city-county plan to address homelessness. The city has a lot to do with housing and zoning and police response, and the county is the place where we have a lot of our supportive services that people need and where our skilled social workers are that can meet people and help them with what they need.
Brian, before we dig into that five-year plan, I want to get a sense of what's going on right now. Of course, a winter, a very frigid winter up till a few days ago in Wisconsin. Is there enough shelter space for those emergency needs, for people who don't have a place to go to take shelter in La Crosse right now?
No, there isn't. Our 24/7 shelter that we have in the city of La Crosse is Salvation Army, and they are full or at capacity all the time. And when there is an opening, it fills very quickly. So they have to turn away multiple people on a daily basis. And really, there's a lack of shelter beds and shelter capacity in our community right now.
And Brian, I know in the plan you're thinking bigger, and we'll get to that in a minute. Is there a sense that, okay, we need more emergency capacity now-ish?
Yeah, that is part of our plan, which is called Pathways Home. In our plan, it's called a temporary surge in shelter beds. And so that is something that we've been actively working on and are addressing. But in our goal, again, isn't to create a permanent long-term shelter in our community that has added beds, but we do want to come up with a bridge or temporary solution for that surge in shelter beds in our community.
And Jim, Brian just mentioned that plan, Pathways Home. Both you and Brian and your respective jobs at the forefront of this effort. What are some of the things in this partnership? What are some of the goals you're reaching toward here?
Yeah, so year one was largely about building the system and aligning the many great agencies and resources working on this issue. Year two, which is 2025, is about working towards ending the crisis of unsheltered homelessness. And two big deliverables this year. One is releasing a specialized housing plan that covers the type and quantity of housing our community needs, and then sets strategies and priorities to execute that plan. And secondly, as Brian alluded to, because the timing of housing development takes time, we're looking to stand up an emergency temporary shelter so any folks living outside have a safe option. That also helps us ability to serve and support them.
I want to dig into the big picture of this plan. Now, Brian, the Homeless Action Plan says the goal is to achieve functional zero by 2029. What do we mean by functional zero?
Functional zero means a couple of different things. Number one being that as a community, we can get more people into housing every month than people who are entering homelessness. So if we have 50 people entering homelessness in a month, we have the ability as a community to house 51 or more people. Secondly, it means that if we do everything we can to prevent somebody or household from entering homelessness, But if they do enter homelessness and slip through those cracks, they're only experiencing homelessness for 30 days or fewer. That's really the benchmark. And then finally, it's a one-time occurrence. Is if somebody's experiencing homelessness, that's the first and only time they'll ever have to experience something like that. They don't cycle in and out of housing. We're able to, as a community, help them get back on their feet, get into housing, and then they're able to stay there long-term.
Jim, our picture of homelessness sometimes is, okay, a person who's living permanently on the street. But as I talk to people in communities around the state, homelessness might be hidden. It might be that person who's having to stay in a car for extended periods of time, or couch surfing, or leaning on friends or family for brief transitory stays. How important is it to factor that into the effort here, not just the people we might see on street and think, ah, homeless person?
Absolutely. No, that's a whole collection of folks that might come into our system. As Brian alluded to, while some of them might technically meet the HUD definition of being homeless, they're at high risk of becoming homeless. And so looking at how we can prevent folks from even dropping into that homeless category, even for a day, is really super important.
We're talking about La Crosse's action plan to end homelessness in the region, functionally end homelessness in the region by 2029. We have Brian Sampson, the city's homeless coordinator, and Jim Dries, the County of La Crosse homeless response manager. Brian, take us into the practical hopes for what this is going to look like. A person is homeless by that 2029 guideline, tried to say, okay, no more than 30 days of homelessness for them. What could that look like, the process of getting them into not temporary housing, not emergency housing, but an ongoing housing situation?
Yeah, the first step is really to identify them. Ideally, in a perfect world, we would be able to identify somebody before they lose their housing. That's the best way that you can help somebody, is when they're already in housing. How can we help them stay in housing, whether that be helping them find a different apartment or a different unit? So ideally, you know, that early intervention is where it's at. So the earlier we can intervene, the better. If somebody then still experiences homelessness after that, then we really want to treat it like a crisis. We have somebody who's readily available to help them search for housing, help them fill out applications, whatever that support may need, and then connect them with any ongoing supports. So that way they avoid whatever caused their homelessness in the first place. They're able to avoid that moving forward.
Jim, along the lines of support for people to be matched up with housing, to find help that they might need, I understand this year La Crosse County is going to add 3 peer specialists and 3 case managers to that Pathways Home program. Can you talk about those positions and the role you're hoping they'll play?
Yeah, you know, La Crosse County launched this specialized unit directed specifically at our homelessness response with 3 social workers last year, and that's been super effective in having them meet people where they are, understand their needs around services and housing, and then work through the process to get them housing. But those 3 aren't enough in our system. Our system today is at capacity in its ability to provide housing navigation and case management. So adding 3 more social workers is significant in terms of the number of people we can support. And another thing that clearly came through listening to our community was the need for these peer support specialists, folks with lived experience who can connect to this population, build trust, and not just the housing, but also help people maintain their housing.
I want to talk, Jim, I will stay with you. The peer part of that seems really important. People who have been through this themselves might have actual valuable life advice for people in this situation. Talk a little more about their role.
Yeah, we know in encampments and homeless community, a lot of that already happens of people looking out for people. There can be a general distrust of the homeless population regarding to institutions and places trying to help them. And really, we need people in places to be able to make really good decisions, understand the options and the path forward for them. And having someone who's been there that can listen to them and provide some guidance on what to go next is really important. And that was really identified by a lived experience team that was part of the original planning of this, the importance of this for this system to really work.
Brian, the La Crosse City Council approved funding of 2 specialized housing proposals with some federal money behind it. Can you talk about what those are going to be, what the timeline is like?
Yeah, what we did, part of Pathways Home, was we created a list of everybody experiencing homelessness in the city of La Crosse. and also got a better idea of what are their housing needs. So not just, you know, who's experiencing homelessness in our community, but how can we help them stop that crisis and get into housing that they want with the supports that they want and need. And so through that process, we are able to identify what are the exact housing needs in our community. And then we use that data to drive decision-making or make recommendations for funding for different types of supportive housing units that will directly address those needs of what that people have identified. So through the ARPA funding that the city council awarded, we will have 26 new units of different level of supportive housing that will come online in 2026.
Now I'm looking at the La Crosse County website, the Pathways page, and I'm seeing monthly stats on the number of people experiencing homelessness. What kind of data collection you're doing, why it was important to you to get more than just that one night count that a lot of communities rely on?
First of all, it's critical for us to know the name of every person who's experiencing homelessness. And we do that through Pathways conferencing and our homeless outreach team with community partners to build that list. And here's one thing we can say from having worked it for more than half a year now, it's a very dynamic system. People are moving about in and out of homelessness. Once a year or twice a year, a point in time count misses that. It also, we don't necessarily know the history of folks, so we can understand what type of housing they might need to be successful.
Brian, I want to widen the lens a little bit. In addition to people experiencing homelessness, at risk of homelessness, I know, talking to people in communities all over the state, there's a lot of people paying more than they could really afford in rent or mortgage. Set the scene for us in La Crosse. What is housing availability, housing stock like in general there?
Yeah, in general, housing is very difficult to find in the city of La Crosse. We have the Mississippi River on one side of us, and we have the Bluffs on the other. So really difficult to grow our community. As part of our community's initiative to address housing, the city of La Crosse actually just completed a housing study. One of the more eye-opening issues that they found was that in order for our community just to catch up on general housing stock, we need to add 200 new units of housing every single year for the next 10 years.
Jim, if there are people listening in other communities around the state thinking, hey, we need this kind of comprehensive approach to homelessness and at-risk people in our community, what would you recommend to them as a starting point?
You know, there's a lot of communities out there facing this challenge, and I would recommend look at similar sized cities across your region, across the country. Part of our program was based on learnings from other communities that are going through this. And I think what you can find out is this is a solvable problem if you coordinate your effort, if you coordinate your resources, and stay focused on the challenge and be willing to invest in it. So I think the first thing is you have to make a decision. Is this a challenge your community supports? And then learn from those that are already doing this. We share information across this. We all have a common goal of reducing homelessness in every community.
And we'll leave it there. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
You are very welcome. Thanks for having us.
And Brian, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Brian Sampson is the Homeless Services Coordinator for the City of La Crosse, and Jim Dries is the Homelessness Response System Manager for La Crosse County. They talked with Rob Ferret earlier this week about the Pathways Home Plan, which aims to reduce homelessness to what's called functional zero by 2029 in this western Wisconsin county. Is there a plan in your community that's focused on solving a persistent problem? We want to hear about the plan and what your community is discovering, and perhaps we can highlight it in a future program. Share your story, share your ideas at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Wisconsin has a shortage of mental health care providers, which has led to longer wait times. As we see artificial intelligence being used in treatment and diagnosis,
In a coming program, we'll be looking into how AI could be filling some gaps, and we want to hear from you about this. Could AI be used to expand and improve mental health therapy in Wisconsin? Or perhaps you have reservations about that. Have you used mental health apps to manage your stress? Or do you use a personal chatbot as a form of therapy? Share your thoughts about mental health and the role of AI. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can get in touch with us by sending a text or leaving a message at 888-642-0232. And here's the thing, we humans on Wisconsin Today read, we listen to, and we reflect on what you send our way. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.